The founder of Panasonic once said,
"We can lead more meaningful and constructive lives
through the pursuit of activities that will ensure
a better today than yesterday,
a better tomorrow than today."
Panasonic is committed to creating a greener,
more equitable future for everyone.
Explore Panasonic Green Impact
at na.panasonic.com/greenimpact.
Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about season 4, episode 8, titled The Nadir. Aaron, what'd you think of this? The low point? I don't know. The Nadir of Fargo season 4? Yeah. I thought it was a higher point than that, but...
We've hit rock Fargo bottom here, baby. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to tell you. If you're looking for flights of fancy from here... I like this episode. I thought this episode is a lot better than the last two that were pretty uneven. I do think it suffers from like, you know, I'm on the internet. I see what people are saying on Twitter and on Reddit and what people are writing in their professional reviews. I'm not going to say that this works 100% because I think they fucked up some of the foundational pieces that would have made this play off beautifully. But, you know, at some point you kind of have to like declare fan bankruptcy or kind of get rid of your, like, you know, when a show tries to do something, it doesn't quite do it, but then it's got to proceed from the standpoint as if it succeeded. Yeah. You either stop watching the show or you play along and be like, oh, okay. So I think there's a little bit of that going on. That's the fucking up the FADA side of the business. Everything else I think is pretty much firing on all cylinders. And I enjoyed the action sequences for what they were. I thought the duel between Deffy and Loy Cannon in his living room was amazing and really entertaining to watch. A great way for Timothy Olyphant to kind of go out on top as a weird, bizarro, racist Raylan Givens. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought it was pretty good. And I also think that, like, I'm starting to understand that, like, this is less a season of Fargo than a morality play that Holly's putting on about immigrants in America.
Okay.
And if you look at it from that perspective, I think it's pretty successful. How many people want to engage with it at that level? I don't know. But I'm you know, so many people are going to have to be talking about this in a podcast or on this Wizard of Oz, you know, thing. But, like, to me, this is a tale of, like, people coming to America and thinking they're Americans, not really wanting to talk about the fact that they displaced the original Americans. And then when newer Americans come and cause friction, then that's a problem. And it's all about, like, you know, again, what does it mean to be Americans? And all of the sides are represented, you know, immigrants, Native Americans, the sons and daughters of former slaves brought here against their will. It's all the original white Anglo-Saxon, the original Americans, the one we're here, you know, they crossed the land bridge back in the last ice age and settled the land. They're the ones, you know, it's like, it's all the characters are there. And I think it's really interesting to analyze it from that standpoint. What did you think though?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I found this episode to be much more enjoyable than the last couple. If not purely for a couple of like keystone scenes, like that, you know, Raylan Givens scene with Timothy Olyphant, where he just, you know, goes in and, in my opinion, says something true about criminals. I think he has, like, identified a very specific trait of criminals, and one that I probably agree with if I were to sit down and think about it. That whole scene is badass, including, you know, the quick draw that you were talking about before this podcast. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, going into the shootout at the end of the episode, the funny thing is you don't see 90% of it, right? Like, you don't see the actual shootout part. You see much more of the shootout in Gaetano and Giusto's backyard, right? Than you do in the train station there. So it's mostly implied, but man, it really works. Like when you see the aftermath, you know, and Fargo does this a lot, right? They take these battles, and I had speculated that maybe they would do this at Joplin's hardware or general store before the season was right. up, and they might still. But you remember like a couple of shots where they would just show the exterior of a gun battle that was going on inside of a building, right? And sort of tracking that with blown out windows and things sure. like that. This feels like another one of those scenes where they don't show you the shootout. They just show you everything swirling around it. And that feels very Fargo to me, but it also feels very effective in like, I get a sense of chaos that maybe I might not if I were grounded in the action.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really, really like those scenes. I'm still not sure how to feel about that Gaetano stuff because coming out of it, the shootout, I don't know how he runs these people off with two pistols. But the fact that he's like flipped here on what he thinks Giusto has done, his opinion on Giusto, right? Like this idea that Giusto is somehow the mastermind. And, you know, he's smarter than Gaetano, but that's not tough.
Yeah.
Gaetano doesn't have any mental process he's going on other than like I'm angry, let me smash something. So
but I think the show knows that though, and the character that we do trust and mm-hmm. has a good head on his shoulders, like every time they cut over to Ebel, he looks like yeah. he's about to swallow his tongue, like oh god, this is now they're yeah. now they're actually working together, oh god, it's yeah, no, I do think that some of that stuff is going to turn out to be intentional, maybe.
It you know, is
commentary
yeah.
that they're doing.
I just can't. But I can't get a read on Gaetano.
Watch? Like, right?
Yeah, that's the biggest question. And yeah, my like, answer so know, that's, far that's, is like sorta.
I mean, that's the danger with morality plays, right? Like, are they entertaining? Like if you want to moralize, why do you put it in the form of a play? Because it's more palatable to people. It's more entertaining. And I do wonder. It's like, yeah, if the story is like, well, these are just all dumb criminals. And they're joining forces together to keep the black man down. That's a cool. I mean, sure, fine. But is it going to be fun to watch? You know, yeah. Otherwise, you know, the morality play is not going to work. It seems like to me though. Like I think it's fun to watch. It's just, man, Gaetano is a hard guy to wrap your head around, and sure. Giusto is a hard guy to kind of empathize with. Although they do humanize him a bit, you know, mm-hmm. with his. Backstory that we kind of hinted at in earlier episodes.
This episode is brought to you by Rakuten. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Samsung, Expedia, and Sephora. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I do want to talk, before I split into everything's business, because there's one scene that kind of is oddly disconnected from everything, and that's the introduction, where you've got the, man, I was having flashbacks of season 3 with the extreme close-up on Giusto's mouth
yeah,
chewing this Varga. Animal flesh. Yeah, yeah, this is Fargo became Vargo for like, you know, 10 or 15 seconds here, watching this guy chew this meat.
Uh-huh.
And having this weird, so like, I don't understand. I thought this was going to be a much bigger part of the plot. Giusto taking over city hall, you mm-hmm. know, But I don't understand the machinations, because the mayor obviously is getting nervous, probably because of the body count that's racking up in his town, and he's like maybe losing his election. But this has been such a non-story. We've only seen this guy like twice previously, and like I don't get the political angle. There's no scenes. There's no scenes of him calling and being like, "Why are you raising taxes? This is an election year. Why can't you fucking get it?" Like. So, like, what is the stakes here? To me, it's like, is like this just here to cause friction between him and Mayflower? I don't get it.
It doesn't feel important at all. Like, I don't know what Justo gets. Like, they haven't made it explicit, right? There's the implicit, like, oh, well, if you have a mayor in your pocket, then of course you'll get special treatment. Like, the cops might not come after you as hard. Like, there's all that implicit stuff, but the explicit stuff is what I want to know. What does Justo specifically want out of this relationship? And they haven't done any of that.
Yeah, especially since, like, okay, your old man arranged this marriage. This is some Game of Thrones shit. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, why are you openly antagonizing this guy? Like, why are you doing the blowjob?
Because he's kind of shit. Thing? I don't know.
Yeah. But that doesn't, like, so, again, the narrative is this guy is incompetent, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he acts like he's got some kind of political favor all sewn up when, like, this, look, man, I've seen Godfather.
Yeah.
You want me to believe that Justo is Michael Corleone, even a bad version of him? He should at least be trying. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he should be going through the motions, and just maybe the motions aren't very satisfying, or they don't work as well as they would if someone actually good was doing them. But this is just like, yeah, I don't know what the stakes are. I don't know who these people are. I don't know how it fits into the wider political story. So it's like, eh. But yeah. It is a sick shot of him eating meat, though.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Sure. And the other stuff, you know, is it leads right into this Orietta stuff, which I think is much better.
Yeah. So we're going to go into the Mayflower business now. We're going to stay on that subject for a bit. There's this interesting conversation between Justo and Mayflower about their backgrounds. I actually really liked how they made it very clear that Mayflower is a victim of Manchauser by proxy, but they don't actually come out and say it.
Uh-huh.
Like, Justo doesn't connect the dots. It's just, really rough upbringing.
Yeah, so many of these things, I wonder, like, at the time, would they even have understood sort of what some of these things are, right? Like, when I think of Weff and his tics and his thing, they... Like, it's got to be hell to go to the doctor and them to have no way to diagnose anything you've got going on, right? And just saying, well, suck it up, or
whatever. You got to relax. You got to relax, buddy, out there in a minefield.
Right, you know? And then him having to go out and figure his own solutions out, right? Like, he talks about, we'll get to all that, but, you know, he tried to figure his own solutions out, and I think, like, Orietta maybe not understanding what Munchausen by proxy is at that point.
I wouldn't imagine, like, the idea that a mother would deliberately do something to harm their child is like so far beyond the pale that it's like the perfect crime,
right?
Because the shield is, oh my god, I'm a mother, of course, like, you know,
of course. And so, then you're friendly with the doctors, like she describes, and
which
and,
you would be, and yeah, you're probably really familiar with the different, and they have these like horse shit, like you know, failure to thrive and
right.
I mean, I think I read an article one day that, like, you remember the hysteria around SIDS, like the sudden death syndrome?
Yep.
That was almost entirely due to how we were having babies sleep, and that, like, SIDS is like falling off the map when we got to, like, hey, you know, don't have a bunch of thick, fluffy blankets that's going to suffocate your kid. Don't put them on their belly.
Uh-huh.
And, like, you know, they had this whole syndrome from, like, parents just rolling over their kids on their belly because they'll be more comfortable to sleep, and then they suffocate themselves.
Oh.
I don't know if that's true. That's like you might want to Google that. That might be something I heard and it's not true.
Uh-huh.
But like, I do think that you're right on there with the, like, they just didn't understand this, and the whole, you know, her being this grim reaper of nurses. I think that's the same kind of thing. Like, it's very like the hospital system doesn't want to confront it. Like, it's almost a too horrible reality. But we also got, like, this is something that I brought up a couple weeks ago when we were thinking about the Milligans and how the mugshot of old man Milligan said that he was arrested for sexual perversion. And there was this theory that, you know, the thing that haunts, like, you know, Rabbi Milligan and whatnot is the fact that maybe his dad molested him. And maybe that's why he was so, you know, keen to have him killed. Well, we got confirmation of that, essentially, right? This guy did unspeakable, unnatural things for 3 years to Josto, and it fucked him up.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I don't know where that's going, though.
I'm okay with characterization for characterization's sake.
That's true.
You know, if you can round out a character and make me empathize with them more, I think that's a good thing, almost universally.
Yeah, yeah. They also got in this interesting conversation about patron saints. And I, for the first time, I was looking into Ethelreda, and it's spelled differently, but there is actually a Saint Ethelreda in Roman Catholic lore. She grew up in the 7th century. She was the princess of this king, this Anglo-Saxon king. But she was known as a revolutionary figure. Once she dedicated her life to Christ, she freed all the bondsmen, the people who were essentially enslaved to the estate, and lived like this aesthetic life. And I think there's something interesting. She's also the patron saint of sore throats. That's it.
What is going on in that church? What is happening?
I don't know. I don't know. And hold on a second.
Is there a patron saint of Munchausen by proxy?
Well, that's where I was going. She's the patron saint of throat complaints. And I wonder if there is something that there.
I have a throat complaint to lodge.
I have something lodged in my throat. That's the complaint.
Yep.
I do like there's like some kind of choking theme there. I don't know. Something with Mayflower. But then the real meat of this is she calls the hospital while Josto's taking a piss after she's worked him over, because she's really working him over, Jim, and finds out that he's making a full recovery.
Bad news for her.
And this, she gets this news that Josto, because she's fallen for Josto, right? And Josto's kind of fallen for her, but he's got this arranged marriage and she's not too keen on this. Well, this just blows that situation wide open, and she starts... Mayflower, when she's got a head of steam behind her, is hilarious.
Oh, her,
like her little feet stomping.
I know, man, running down that hallway.
Yeah, and like every like third or fourth stomp, she kind of gets a half stomp in because she's almost like it's like caught between a trot and a gallop. It's the physical acting that she's doing is chef's kiss.
Jessie Buckley, is that her name?
She's
very good. Very good. We saw her in I'm Thinking of Ending Things recently, a Netflix movie by Charlie Kaufman. And that was really
very
good
worth
too.
Checking out. Very worth checking out if you want to see a completely 180 degree different performance out of this this woman.
Yeah.
So Mayflower stomps off. She throws out Josto. Doesn't want to see him again. She also then goes to her hospital and she's stomping around trying to find out. Finds out that Dr. Harvard has been transferred to a special hospital that deals exclusively with poisoning and is under police guard because, of course, this is the second attempt on his life.
Mm-hmm.
And they think this is like fada business related. Sure. And Mayflower has about 3 cows while she's standing there talking to this lady. And then you thought she was high speed stomping before. Wait till you see this routine. Her flying around her house trying to rapidly pack. She goes through, tries to pack up all of her patient mementos, and then she finds the fucking journal.
What we all knew she was going to find.
It's like the bride in Kill Bill. She has her own little personal like siren go off, and she goes to the window, and of course Ethelreda's got to be coming out of her front porch to take the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this like 2-minute hate sequence that she... she delivers, and it's really good. Like that's some premium malice that she's working.
Oh yeah. I gotta wonder, like, so the law's gonna be coming for her, right? Like Harvard wakes up, Harvard tells them, hey, I ate these macaroons, according to him. I immediately fell over. Like there's, unless he's a Fargo character and he doesn't connect the dots,
I don't honestly know. I know this is like a trope in TV shows, which is makes it good enough to discuss. But like, there's this idea that, you know, when you go on an anesthetic, part of the thing is like, you know, it makes you unconscious. But part of it also is an amnesiatic. You know, like it actually the loss of consciousness kind of like does something to your short term memory, so that you might not remember the first, you know, you don't remember counting off completely down to 10 when you fall unconscious and stuff. I wonder if they're going to say something like, well, he lost consciousness and he's real fuzzy about what happened right before he died. Like, he remember, maybe, you know, because the thing is like, if he takes the cookie and gets poisoned, that's one thing, because it could still be like the Fada gang involved. I don't know how she would do it, though. But like, the thing that really condemns her is like the fact that she ruffled through his papers, stole that letter, and just coldly, like, you know, wiped the crumbs off his face. Will he remember that? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if he does remember anything, then she's in big trouble.
It does feel like it's something that she could go to Josto and be like, this suits both of our, you know, things. We need to kill this guy before. But like, why would Josto agree to that? Because that would just put the noose around his neck.
Yeah. He's already under scrutiny.
Maybe she can convince him on the other side of a feather pillow, because he seems maybe like doing her footwork on him. I don't know. She have a way to convince him. But she seems fucked. I think you're right. Like, she's going to be on the lam. She's going to be trying to take vengeance on Ethelreda and then getting the fuck out, it seems like.
So,
yeah, how she might never even see Josto again.
Maybe not.
That can't be. I don't know. Okay, let's go into Fada business. So after Mayflower throws him out of his apartment, he's got a real head of steam. He's on the move. The trademark kind of like jazzy Mr. Wrench drums from season 3 are kicking in. And he gets back to his house. And you know what? Gaetano the Bull, he's back. Throws him through a table, beats him to unconsciousness. When he wakes up, says that, hey, I realize that I'm the bull and you're the snake and I'm swearing loyalty to you. And he swears loyalty to him in front of the whole gang.
Yeah.
I just think that I just don't understand this character, because I thought they told me he was a paper tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And now he is back to being this superhuman killing machine.
Yep.
I don't understand how he had that reaction. Or am I supposed to understand that Swanee and Zelmer are just that badass that the mere sound of gunfire from their fingertips is so distinctly feminine and wrathful that, you know, Gaetano wanted no part of it? I don't get it. Like, that one scene you take out of the season, I buy all this shit. I buy the fact that this guy's dumb, but he's just smart enough in to see through his haze of red rage. He gets some limoncello in him and realizes, wait a second, this cannon guy wants me to do this. He's my enemy. I should do the opposite. But I
don't know. Like, it's hard for me to gauge, because, yeah, I think like there have been a couple missteps, in my opinion, in this character's arc. And yeah, you might like say, OK, well, he sees Loy's plan. But did he also see Josto's plan? Because Josto's plan is to let him die. He admires it, but I don't know. I always have a problem like when a show tries to tell me that like a character is happy that something bad could have happened to them when it didn't, like, because it's for a greater purpose. It's really, really hard to sell that, and I don't think the show has done a good enough job. Like, they just sort of instead of like trying to explain it, they just have him do it. Just have him forgive him and explain to him like why this is such a, oh, I see what you did there. Like, yeah, but that was your life. I don't know.
I think it is like if the reason you're trying to take over the family from your older brother is because you think he's weak and he's not capable of doing the things that must be done. And then he murders your rival's kid and tries to murder his own brother, secure power. I think that part makes sense. It's just that, like, Gaetano himself. Yeah, no, I get it. But like, you know, even when they were beating him half to death, he was saying, you know, hey, it's family. Family is family. What are you going to do? Like I said, the only flaw I think in this character is what him kind of freaking out with Zelmer and Swanee. You know, if he had like bravely faced them and they just outfought him, because apparently they're fucking dynamite with a gun.
Yeah,
like they clean out a whole train station to cops, and only Raylan fucking Givens was able to bring him the heel when they ran out of bullets.
Yeah.
Like, okay, they're badass. I get it. But, like, is he badass? And if he's badass, then they're badass, or he should have come in direct conflict, and but they didn't do that. And he got taken down by, he shot his own guy in pant shitting terror, and then the lady snuck in the open window behind his back and got him. That was it. Yeah. I don't know. So, the other thing is, like, Evil looks like he's about to have multiple panic attacks during, because what is his deal? Like, okay, Josto's an idiot, Gaetano's an idiot, now they're an idiot chain that can't be broken.
Uh-huh.
Like, did he have an idea that he might be able to, like, reason with one or the other, but if they're both working together, it's...
I just think he's on a train that's headed off a cliff, and he is powerless to do anything about it. Because, like, he's...
Right.
The look that he gives, and when he's, like, boss, when, you know, he's talking to Loy last episode, saying, hey, we killed your kid, you know, Gaetano killed Gaetano instead. All of that to me is a guy who is just losing any kind of grip on influence that he had in this thing.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, he's still in his position. He's still in this family. There's nothing he can do to change it, but he's stuck on it.
Well, and there's also, like, I do think they're telling a story about how dumb these guys are, because, mm-hmm. like, there's a scene later on where Gaetano is like, so... You didn't even know the kid was killed, and you can. Oh, what would you have done if this? The Irish had done the obvious play, and he's like, and then he thinks that's just like, oh, look at the balls, my boy, my brother's got. He takes, he risks it all on a bad crap throw, and crapped out. Oh, look at the balls.
It's
this
not
kid.
That he had calculated. Oh, you know, there's a slim chance of that happening. It's that he hadn't even thought about it. He hadn't even considered that as a possibility. So his whole plan was based on. Just some faulty assumptions, and I don't know.
So now my other question is, how does this impact what we think of Loy? Because we thought that Loy had this really genius plan involving conspicuously sending these deadly women to this train station and having this problematic marshal there, and they were leaking that information and all that kind of stuff. Either he's playing not just 16th dimensional chess, but 24th dimensional chess, and this is all continued to be part of the plan, or that is not true, and his actual plan was, just hope the brother kills him and then deal with the dumb strong one, and when that doesn't come to pass, then he's just, you know, going with the Fargo option. Fargo option, not great, by the way. And I guess we can talk about that scene.
Yeah, because I think you're right. I think that's exactly what happened. He made a play, it failed, and now he's on plan B.
He's on plan B, which is, you know, that's always the smart character has, like, you know, three paths of victory after the first one, but also not the elaborate mastermind plan I was hoping from Loy Cannon. So we go, Josto's out smoking. His brother comes out with a big bottle of, I can only assume, limoncello, makes his brother drink.
No, it's like, Irish whiskey. What are they doing with that?
Interesting. Well, it's the devil. Like,
okay.
I mean, the devil is Irish.
I mean,
that they're, you know, this is, he's being forced to drink it. Oh, God.
Yeah.
I
was trying to think of, like, what is the implication there, but
by a larger, more physically powerful person. Yeah. I don't know what the fuck you're doing with this part of the morality play, Holly. You've kind of lost me on this one, but they get it, you know, it's like Joe Pesci visiting in his mom's house at 3 o'clock in the morning with a corpse in the trunk. It's like cute.
Yeah.
Then the Fargo team rolls in with their rifles that Loy gave him earlier this season. They gun down 4 or 5 of the Fada muscle. They take their best shot at Gaetano and Josto. Gaetano runs them off with 2 pistols just in Han Solo mode.
Yeah.
Which that can happen. You know, if you bought it when Han Solo did it in Death Star, stop bitching about it now. But then they come back and the true tragedy is their mom's dead. And I think that's their sister. The one who was married to the Camp Pleasant guy.
I just knew it was the mom and that was going to be a problem.
Yeah, so their mother and sister are both murdered and Gaetano is just insane with grief and rage. Is he going to still meekly accept his role as the bull and let the snake plan things out? Really?
I think he's going to be, you know, pushing for revenge. And I think, you know, Josto's going to have to, whether he wants to, you know, go in guns blazing or not, he's going to have to.
Yeah. That will kind of be beyond frustrating with Gaetano just next week. Like,
Jostos
like, hey, you know, I'm the snake and you're the bull, buddy. We're going to get a revenge. Just that, no, we got to go right out. I'm going to be like, okay.
I mean,
right,
I can see him lobbying for that, but if he then goes off,
oh, yes,
you know, and just takes matters into his own hands, yeah, it's going to be frustrating.
But all Jostos should have to say is, like, look, I get it. I'm the snake. We're going to have, and then Gaetano should fucking relax, as if he doesn't, then this whole week, everything of me, like, buying this character and going along with it goes out the window, and I'm like, I don't get it. Okay, let's, I think we're done with the fada business. Let's move on to some smutney business. We haven't had much smutney business that involved Ethel Rita for a while. And there's another really good monologue, I guess dueling monologue scene. Deborah Smutney opens the door and turns out it's Buell, Loy Cannon's wife. She's here to see her son, to tell him that his baby brother's dead. They have a really good scene in the kitchen where Buell's like, I know what you're going to do. You're going to ask for me to intercede because we go way back. We grew up on the same street and we went to the same church and we used to braid each other's hair and it ain't going to work. And Deborah's like, oh, well, have you considered that I'm going to try and it's going to work anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And it's honestly a great scene. And it's a very careful piece of acting work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's absorbing and in the same kind of way like the early scenes of The Godfather are, where the camera just sits there and like you drink in these people's face and their expression and the rhythm of their dialogue. But at the end, you know, I think you're going to understand that Deborah is going to host the funeral services for Cannon. And this moves Buell so much that she's going to intercede for the family on behalf of Loy Cannon. That doesn't really make sense to me, though, because what other half black owned funeral parlor is going to do the work? Like, I just assume that, of course, if they're going to have a service at all, it'd be done at this place. So it's like, and also, Loy owns this place.
Yeah, yeah.
Loy owns this building now. So, like, how did this? I think you're supposed to understand that the story of Ethel Rita is what the real grease is here.
Okay.
And maybe Buell's looking for a way to, like, how I can sell this to Loy. But if I'm at Loy and my wife comes to me and says, you know what, Smutney's going to do us a solid. They're going to let us use their funeral parlor and go out on his services. He's going to be like, woman, we own this business. Yes, of course they're going to do it.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah,
and they're going to move bodies for us and money and launder money and all kinds of shit. Come on. Like, what?
This feels more like an emotional plea to be okay with doing this rather than actually doing it. Like, look, this is my child. He got mixed up in this business and was killed. Look, I'm in a very similar place to you here. You know, I'm also a bit of a hostage in this relationship. Understand what this means to me and be okay with doing it rather than just doing it because there's a gun to your head. Kind of the vibe I got from this scene. And man, there's a line in there that struck me when Buell, is that her name?
Yeah, yeah.
Says there's always lower you can go. You know, Debril's talking about how, like, you know, they've lost everything and you know, they've got this thing hanging over them. But she says there's always lower you can go. And it struck me because Loy Cannon trying to get this credit card thing going is like the epitome of that. Like, it's not bad enough if you don't have any money. We have now invented mechanisms to allow people to gamble their future in a way with like credit cards and debt and things and then lose it. Right. And they mm-hmm. be stuck in that hole, be lower than sea level when it comes mm-hmm. to, you know, financial life and just everything about the way they're living. So like, I couldn't help but see them tied up in that idea of like, there's always lower you can go.
Yeah. It's such a good point you made about her being stuck in this relationship too, because, you know, she thought maybe just like the stress and the lifestyle was bad before, but now, and the other thing that's crazy is like, we're talking about Satchel as if he's dead and he's not.
Sure.
And that's like, it is wild to see that this go for multiple episodes, that there's this false information that Milligan's out in liberal Kansas, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like it though.
I'm,
you know, it's, yeah, it's yeah, it allows yeah. us to stay in this like, weird in-between zone.
And they do some other cool stuff, too. Like, Ethel Reed is upstairs. She's listening to music. And there's this kind of, like, camera pushing in on her from a first-person perspective. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, it's Mr. Snowman. We're going to see Mr. Snowman here.
Uh-huh.
But it's Lemuel. Lemuel ready to run some pretty slick game on Ethel Reed. Like, this is a pretty A-plus flirting game he's got here.
Sure, you start off talking about jazz, improvisation. There's a vibe to that, slightly negging her
and her old man's taste. I like that way he said, I've never heard a cooler way to say something's corny by saying, yeah, somebody, a lot of these albums little off the cob. Like, I love it. I've never heard that expression before, but I'm definitely going to steal it.
You know exactly what it means.
I'm
going to
appropriate that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's great. And she's also, the other thing is, like, she's looking at the ring. I thought, sure, this, like, we had a kissing of the ring. He don't got the ring. What is the importance of this ring? Is it going to be the only evidence she's got to use against Nurse Mayflower? Really?
It feels like that ship has sailed, though. Like, I don't think evidence is what she needs, right? She needs a gat or something to, like, protect her.
Sure. Do you think that ring is going to contain poison? Like, it's an old mafia ring that flips open and you could, like, you know, some kind of trick ring? You know, the old mafia rings. You got one, didn't you, Jim? You got one passed down.
Handed down.
In a family.
Had to supply my own poison, though. That was all dried
the
up.
Poison oath? There you go. You need poison to do the poison oath. That's Josto's problem here.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what they're doing with the ring other than, like, she's just contemplating, you know. I don't even know, because I can't tell if she's looking.
For them to keep reminding us.
Is she looking at it thinking, like, this is an interesting curiosity? Is she, like, what is she doing pondering this ring? Like, what's going through
her
head?
I don't know. I guess I buy her pondering it because she just set up Mayflower, you know, to go up the river. And maybe she's, like, thinking about that decision in terms of the French music she's listening to, which is, I think, isn't that an affectation she got from Mayflower? Like, she spoke French, but did she sit around listening to French jazz records before?
That's a good question. You might be right about that.
I think it's just mentally connected. I imagine, like, as a 17-year-old, if you just turned state's evidence on a nurse and trying to send her away for multiple murder, that you would be thinking about her, right?
Well, yeah, but thinking about it in what way? Like, is she regretting it? Is she savoring it? Is she?
Yeah, she's so inscrutable.
Yeah, it's tough to read her.
Which I think is great. I wish there's more of her in the season. Because, like I said, she feels like a really weird secondary main character so far. But right as Lemuel's really laying the moves on her daughter, Deborah comes in to fetch him for his mom. And she sees the look that's going on and she warns her daughter, like, you stay away from this boy, he's trouble. Which, of course, is just going to make Ethel Rita think he's even more fascinating and mysterious and desirable. If I know my teenagers,
Ethel Rita's a little unique. You know, she says as much, but
yeah,
teenagers. Yeah, you tell them not to do something, they'll probably want to do it more.
Yeah. So that's the Smutney business. Pretty light, but they're setting up for more things to come. And then we're going to end with just a bunch of official U.S. Marshal business. Deffy shows up at Loy Cannon's house. Opal tries to run him off, but he will not be run off. And they have a debate about the criminal mindset, because Loy starts the speech with, I can't give these women up. I guarantee their safety. I'm accountable for them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just like, this is straight out of the Justified playbook here. Timothy Oliphant making these long, impressive, long-winded, kind of drawling, folksy speeches that then you don't realize he's putting, you know, he's assembling the weapon that he's going to use to kill you at the, rhetorically in the last bit. And he goes around, and I've seen like a dozen of these speeches in movies, and I'm always impressed when someone can come up with a new way to kind of crystallize the essential difference of the outlaw and the criminal from the civilian life. Like, what is the essential detour? And it's the transactional nature, right? And he points it out to him. It's like, this is I said all this stuff to make this point. If you gave up your youngest son, like Abraham gave up Isaac, to just to get power and money, you're going to have a single problem giving up these strangers to avoid me, you know, putting my boot up your ass. And you know, Loy can laugh and he can try to act like he's got the upper hand and he can threaten this guy that he's not going to make it out of state alive, which turned out to be true. Mm-hmm. But he still loses the essential part of the argument here.
Yeah. I mean, he proves Deffy right by the end of this scene where he gives up Sewanee and Zalmair. So, yeah, no, he knows exactly where the loyalties of the criminal lie. And you know, they've been doing this stuff all season, right? The mantra of the Italians, business, family, country. That shows you the order that they put these things in. And family's not on top there.
It was great seeing Timothy Olyphant pull off a quick draw.
Yeah.
It's super, super fucking cool, especially since, you know, it's like, it's just great. The other thing that's interesting is another Fargo connection is this response that Loy gives about, you know, I like you. Us Mormons are nice people. Nah, you're unfriendly. And though it's a way you're unfriendly, like you're doing me a favor, this is a callback to Mike Milligan meeting Lou Salverson for the first time in Fargo season two. They had this exact same exchange, except for over Lou's Minnesota nice
right
accent.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just it's great. It's great. Yes. I can say nothing bad about this particular scene. It just completely works on all levels. It needs to work. Timothy Olyphant is a beast. Chris Rock is amazing. Like the restraint he plays the restrained performance he gives when Oliphant's like, you know, you don't strike me as a guy who thinks himself is wrong, and he just kind of rolls out of his mouth. Rarely. tell me exactly why you think that it's like it's good. It's good.
And that at the end when he gives Opal a look like, oh shit, he did not like that you let him in his house. You know,
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff like, you know, that's just the cool parts of the scene. There's also a lot of like ugly stuff, like the way that he punctuates. You know, you can kind of forgive yourself by thinking of Raylan Givens and what a good guy he is, but every once in a while Timothy Olyphant throws in a boy, like with a bit of malice and venom, and it's like, oh no, right, this guy's you know, he's like the law, but you know, the law's not exactly the vanguard of truth and justice everywhere, especially in 1950s America.
Sure.
So it just worked on every level it needed to. We then see after Loy Cannon obviously gives the two women up, Deffy's leading a tactical briefing at the police station. He concludes it with Psalms after the boys have a chuckle about his backdoor joke. Did you notice that there is a Mr. Snowman sitting on the desk that Deffy's standing in front of? And its face is carved to look almost exactly like the Mr. Snowman ghost.
What do you mean there's a Mr. Snowman? Like there's a snowman?
There's literally a Frosty the Snowman Christmas festive thing. And his face is carved to look like a frowning skull.
The hell? No, I didn't notice that.
I thought it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool foreshadowing because I'm honestly looking for Mr. Shadow. I'm looking for Mr. Snowman. I'm watching this like The Haunting of Hill House now.
Right.
Like every
right.
time there's a shadow under staircase, where's the fucking ghost face?
Yeah.
You know, every time the camera kind of lingers over someone's shoulder, where's Mr. Snowman? Like, I'm not going to be scared by this guy. So I, my hypervigilance allowed me to uncover Mr. Snowman standing there in plain sight. Anyway, Detective Weff gets a call. I think he plays this straight. I think that, and I don't even think Alan Sepinwall got this, because his take was that Weffy had a change of heart. He wanted to be a true blue policeman. I think Loy said, kill the marshal. I think Weff was told to kill the marshal and let these women go, or maybe kill everybody and eliminate the evidence. But I think he's still Nick Cannon's guy. Sorry, Loy Cannon. He's still Loy Cannon's guy.
Yeah. I think you could be right. Like, I'm thinking back through the episode. Okay, how does that track? Like, he's super nervous, but is he super nervous because he's got to go into this dangerous shootout situation? Or is he super nervous because he knows that in this dangerous shootout situation, he's got to kill the U.S. Marshal and potentially, you know, he's got to kill everyone. Yeah, I suppose it could be either way. I just kind of took it at face value, but there's no reason I really should have. You know what? I think it's because of the speech he gives. I think it's this power versus risk thing, this felt so honest to me. When he's talking about, you know, his symptoms and how he went to these doctors and they just told him just relax, dude. And he had to go out searching for his own solutions to these problems. That was such an honest, like, heartfelt human moment that to say, oh, but he could also be lying about something in that
mix.
I
think that
you're right. It's probably more likely that he was.
And it also fits thematically because, you know, Deffy so far has been very proud of his ability to judge character. And what is this thing he's afraid of? He's afraid of being caught out, being caught with his boots off, being taken unaware, a petty death. And that's what he gets at the hand of this corrupted person, you know?
Yeah. They spent so much time making Wef look weaker and weaker each of these progressive episodes that to have that running through my head would have been impossible. Like the idea that he would suddenly, you know, grow a pair or whatever and go execute on his mission. It hadn't even crossed my mind, frankly.
I will say the first time I watched the show, I was like, oh God, Wef, he's going to take a turn to the light at the end. And like, I've been thinking about that. Like, you know, a lot of times when I'm seeing Deffy go after him, I openly asked that question a couple. It's like, is he trying to save Deffy's soul? Or I'm sorry, Detective Wef's soul, or is he trying to like send him up the river?
Right.
And I never could figure it out. And then when this happened, I'm like, well, that's clicking into place. He's trying to save his soul. He's trying to like, okay, I've redeemed you back to the light, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's something satisfying about Deffy just getting caught out, dying with his boots half off.
For sure.
So then we transition to the train station and this is an elaborate, I think a lot of this is an elaborate homage to Brian De Palma's The Untouchables, which is filmed at this exact same station in Chicago, where all the Fargo's, and I don't know whether it's an intentional choice or it's like, oh shit, we're filming here, let's just go ahead, because like, they almost set it up to where like, there's a baby crying, like I was expecting the baby buggy to go over those staircases any moment now and cause chaos. And if you haven't seen Untouchables, stop right now. Go watch the movie. It's good. It's good, and you'll immediately recognize this reference.
I think it's the Union Station in Chicago. Is that right?
Yeah, like Grand Union. I've been there too. I used to take a bus from Indianapolis to Chicago about every other weekend and take the train, the Metra, up to the northern suburbs. It's beautiful, beautiful building.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks amazing. It looks like it's a living period piece. You know, if you want to shoot something that looks like it might be anywhere from 1910 to present day, there you go. These great public works that we built in the early 20th century. But they get to the train station. There's some cool stuff. Number one, Cincinnati. Cincinnati got repped on the I love those clockwork.
Yeah.
The like bulletin board things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So cool. It was a mistake to go to LED from those things. It's just so satisfying to watch them change.
Sure.
So that was cool. Did you notice there's also a train from Sioux Falls that it's train number 666?
Oh, nice. Yeah.
What do you think?
I didn't notice that, but Sioux Falls is ringing some bells when it comes to like the Sioux Falls massacre, which I think we saw depicted in a previous season.
Yeah, it's the UFO climax, the controversial in bald move circles UFO climax.
So the shootout at that motel or whatever it was.
But there was nothing satanic about it, other than I guess, I don't know, evil the men do. I don't know. It's just something I want to throw out there to see if anyone makes a connection. Swanee has got the sweet tooth. She robs his concession man blind. The marshal outside gives Detective Wef a pep talk in the form of a lightly obscene limerick about pelicans.
Yeah. I didn't know what to make of this, but it was funny.
Yeah. Then he jumps out the door, says Geronimo, which, do you know the backstory of this Geronimo stuff?
Yeah, it sounds vaguely racist, if I had to guess, but
well,
I'm not
sure. That's the tagline for America.
Sure.
At best, vaguely racist. You're not. So like, apparently World War II is the invention of the paratrooper. And you know, these guys drafted in service are going to get thrown out of an airplane and arrive safely through a hail of flak on borne on the wings of silk that these parachutes have given them. And when they're in training, like the men, like it was, they were they're all very afraid. And I guess the very first paratroopers, right before they did their first test jump, they saw this movie called Geronimo. That was depicting the life of this Indian, you know, resistance guy. He got caught and arrested three different times, and he died as a prisoner of war. But they were inspired. The story goes that one of the privates, they were teasing him about he's going to be so scared he's going to forget his own name when they call him to jump, and he's like, that's all right, guys, you'll know that I got my courage when I jump out the plane screaming Geronimo. And that became a thing, I guess, like all paratroopers started doing that, and then it spread throughout popular culture. Like anytime you're about to do, it's kind of like hold my beer,
sure,
you know. It's that kind of expression. So yeah, vaguely racist. It's an admiration of this Indian character, but also now the interesting thing is years later, this I think it's the 501st Airborne Unit, the one that this practice originated. They contacted Geronimo's family and asked them if they could incorporate his Indian banner and his name, Geronimo, to their unit patch, and apparently the family gave their permission, because now the 501st have the Geronimo patch on their shoulders when they're jumping out of planes to this day. Interesting. So anyway, back to the scene. The women are waxing nostalgic about their exploits here in Kansas City, and all the time's great tension scene. The law is encircling them, and there's this great scene where Deffy's looking for them and Mr. Snowman shows up, which puts the women kind of on alert, and Zellmayr stands up, and there's just great shot where they lock eyes across the room. I love the way Zellmayr mugs at him.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you got
a reaction, right?
And then they kiss passionately, they draw their guns, and I'm like, oh fuck, this is going to be badass. And unfortunately, in the part, they cut away from the action as the baby starts falling down the staircase. The baby buggy starts falling down the staircase, and we come back at the end of it.
Yeah.
Wef finally gets his courage up, leaves the thing. He goes against a light tide of people rushing and screaming out of the building, finds that Deffy has cornered the women. They're out of ammo, and asks them to handcuff him. And depending on how you interpret it, he has a change of heart at the last minute, or he sees it at his advantage, shoots Deffy, shoots Swanee in the head, and they made it very clear that this isn't one of those headshots, it's not going to be fatal like we saw earlier in the season. And Zellmayr loses her shit, charges Wef, who's kind of like discombobulated. Shot goes wild, she runs off into the night, apparently gets away. And man, the look on Marshall Deffy's face as he's lying there dead is something else. There might be another Mr. Snowman haunting people now, because that's the man, that's a look of rage and accusation that he dies with, looking right at Wef.
Yeah, that's good.
Pretty good.
I guess I'm a little sad we didn't get to see the massacre happen, but man, when they show the aftermath, it's impressive, you know. And I was thinking, they're going to, you know, shoot the cops and stuff, and this will be the bad guys versus the good guys. But it's the innocence that got me, like all these civilians just laying dead at the feet of these people. It's like, oh, brutal.
See, and I think that's a part of the morality play that works really well, because like, and it's not the first time I've seen this, where like a director will like get you like your bloodlust up, like, oh, I'm going to see something cool. And it's very romantic. You know, these women pulling each other in for a passionate embrace. They're drawing their guns. They're going to take a stand against the law. And you're wanting to see it. And then when you see the aftermath, there's all these people, these dead men, women, there might have been some children laying around. And it's like, oh God. Yeah, I didn't want that. Like, it's like the idea you had of Zellmayr and Swanee is finally you have to confront the reality of their existence. Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about it, you know?
Not great.
How do you feel about Sheriff Wefy? Because it's not like he's exactly on the side of Deffy. Marshall Deffy.
Okay.
How do you feel about WEF? Like, it's like there's like all this shifting kind of like as you see like from everyone's perspective, everything kind of seems understandable. But at the end of the day, it's a bloodbath. And I think that's still more yet more commentary about America, you know?
Yeah.
So it's good. We also got, I think, our best look at Mr. Snowman so far.
Right.
And I was shocked to see that he looks like he's wearing colonial era, like early, late 17th century type of, like, you know, brass buttons down and waistcoat type of Ben Franklin shit.
Yeah.
What do you think that means?
Man, he's been the biggest mystery, the biggest question mark of this whole season to me, Mr. Snowman. And I still don't know what to make of it. Like there's a... There's the specter of death. There's the specter of racism. There's all of these things that I've been thinking like, oh, maybe that's it, you know, throughout the season. And it's still, none of it's quite come together.
And it does seem like it's centered on Zelmer and Debril. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's they talk about that family specifically being haunted. She's the one that gave us the name, Mr. Snowman.
But then Swanee's the one to see him in this episode.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, and here's something. I also might be vaguely racist. I think you're supposed to get to understand that because of her mystical Indian connection, her Native American connection, that she's able to see these spirit things just the way she could see her father's second shadow. Like, she's got the sight.
Right.
But
could be.
I don't know, because it's the first time I think that... It's the first time that we... it's the first time we've seen a non-Smutney see it. Because Ethel Reed has seen Mr. Snowman.
Mm-hmm.
We're pretty sure Zalmare's seen him before because she knew he was in the room and she shut her eyes to not see him, but she called him by name. I think this is the first time we've actually seen someone else see him, though.
I think you're right.
As far as I know. So, anyway, that's the episode. That's the nadir. This is the low part. It's all up from here. And yeah. I've heard next episode is something to see. And we're going to be talking about a little bit at the very end of it, because I know some people don't like to go on these things like completely blind, don't like to watch the next time on. So we're going to talk about that at the end of the feedback section. Speaking of...
At Enterprise, we know you're constantly on the move. Getting this...
Thanks, Mom!
Fixing that. You reach a destination. And then it's on to the next. And when life is moving at the speed of, well... life. Enterprise is right there with you, around the corner and around the globe. We'll keep you moving forward. Enterprise, for lives in drive.
Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other toppings, and managing it as one big juicy investment. That's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSC SIPC.
Feedback. Fargo@baldmove.com is where you want to send feedback. We got three episodes left to go. Three episodes to get your thoughts and theories into us. Fargo@baldmove.com. Here's the people that took us up on that proposition. Jeremiah starts off, said... In your discussion for episode 7, you mentioned that Loy using his belt to whip this guy is an homage to Pootie Tang. Well, I'm sure this is true given the tie to Chris Rock. It's also a direct homage to the actual scene from Fargo, which I was so proud of myself for being clever getting the Pootie Tang reference. I forgot in the original film, Shep Proudfoot, the mechanic that connects Jerry with the kidnappers, tracks down Steve Buscemi's character and proceeds to physically whip him after the police chief comes to visit Shep at work. He like just whips Steve Buscemi like a dog because he's so pissed that this shit has come back on him.
Yeah. I do not remember that, but I'll take your word for it. But that's in there.
As soon as I got to Shep Proudfoot, I'm like, fuck, of course. Yes. That's how this happened. So thanks for pointing that out to me, Jeremiah. Isaac from North Carolina said, regarding the show, I was surprised that there wasn't much discussion in episode 7 when Marshall Deffy asked Wef if he's heard of the Blood Atonement when they're discussing raiding the Cannon Gang's headquarters. I've been by no means an expert on Mormonism, but I do know that the Blood Atonement was a controversial practice in early Mormonism encouraged by Brigham Young. in which they believed that the atonement for Christ was of Christ's own blood was insufficient for every sin, and that particularly heinous sins, atonement required the shedding of the sinner's blood. A little Googling reveals that this practice is believed to contribute to the widespread violence surrounding the Mormon church in the mid-1800s, including the Mountain Meadows Massacre of 1857. Not familiar with that. No. I'm only familiar with wild Mormon history through the lens of Beaver Island right. and King Joseph Strang, uh-huh. which is an amazing Google if you want to check into it, by the way.
Yes.
Additionally, it's rumored that there was a vigilante group known as the Danites, that went about murdering apostates and dissidents from the church under the pretense of the blood atonement. Finally, the practice of blood atonement had certain racial implications, as Mormon church had many racist doctrines, such as the opposition to interracial marriage. The murder of black men who violated these doctrines is believed to once again be inspired by the blood atonement. Relating this back to Fargo, I don't know what the exact implication is here, but I think it's quite telling that Deffy mentions blood atonement while he's thoughtfully considering what to do with the Cannon Gang. Is this supposed to be set up some sort of righteous massacre where Deffy comes in guns blazing, as opposed to first trying to arrest the gang members? We'll love to hear your thoughts. Pretty amazing prediction, if so, because that's kind of what happened.
There's some blood spilled.
I wonder... I mean, the plain reading in the morality tale, I think, is that Deffy had to pay a blood atonement for some of the shit that he's pulled.
Sure.
In his time as a U.S. Marshal, probably, and maybe his official capacity in the church, running out those Italian men. Like, that's the story. It's like, if you accept that these guys were mafioso coming to Salt Lake City to cause trouble, then, like, maybe that's some community policing. But if these are just some random Irish people out there to try to go west to make a better living, like so many Americans have done, then he's just a xenophobic racist murderer. Which is the correct answer? Like, it is suspect that, like, that's like the oldest Italian racism in the book, that, like, literally every guy with an Italian accent's down with the mafia.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know, man. I mean, all this stuff strikes me as, like, things that people add on to justify their own actions, you know, like.
Sure.
If it's not racism, it's even more petty than that. It's like, somebody did me wrong and I've got this, you know, blood atonement doctrine that I can just throw out there and we can go fucking deal with it and then take some blood to make me feel better about some probably personal slight or something. I don't know.
Got a scripture for it, so God's cool with it too. So
yeah, or like there's a scripture that I can vaguely interpret that way. It's like it really did the blood of the Son of God is not enough to atone for this, really. You gotta go get some inferior mortals blood too and right. mix it in. Like that's no. They're not going to start doing the sacrament or whatever and have like, oh, you also have to like drink the blood of the person next to you. That's part of it too. Now, no, it's all, I don't know. It's all just people making up bullshit to justify their own actions or to meet their own ends. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, and it's still going on. Like, I just watched, there's passing around this new televangelist guy who's been getting some play because he's crazy. And he was doing some ceremony where he pricked him and another deacon's thumb and they squeezed the blood in the cranberry juice cup and then they mixed it together and drank it for some shit. Like, I don't know. Like I said, I'm a lapsed Christian, but I understood the blood of Jesus was the perfect man shed on behalf of us all, covered all those sins. Like all you had to do is ask for forgiveness and show faith in it. I don't know. Again, I'm a lapsed Christian. Maybe I got it all wrong, but I think anything extra to that is probably antichrist. I don't know. But anyway, thanks for that, Isaac. Let's move on to Jacob, who says, I think Mr. Snowman just may be death. It's another death theory for Mr. Snowman. Or the presence of death. He hangs out in a funeral home where I'd imagine the presence of death would be. He's in Swanee's business when she's on death's door. He's spotted by Zalmair just before some major carnage and death at Union Station. And again, just as Swanee dies. Also, Zalmair is obviously familiar with him, giving him the name of Mr. Snowman. Maybe she's accustomed to being near death due to her high-risk lifestyle as an outlaw and fugitive. To be honest, I don't fully expect that we will have an answer by the end of the season or the show. That's probably a hot correct take right there.
Yeah.
That we're not going to, like, you know, this is going to kind of be somewhat UFO-y and it's just going to come out of nowhere. I wouldn't be at all surprised if it will all just be left wondering and speculating, and that totally works for me in the Fargo universe. I agree with that. The one thing that I still think that nobody's really engaging with is the fact that this is tied to a family curse.
Sure.
Like, everyone speculating about what the symbolism is and all that kind of, that's all well and good, but you got to incorporate into the fact that this is specific to Zelmer and Debril's experience. Mm-hmm. Like, it's explicitly, that's canon. Like, it's stalked them from, what, they go from Mississippi or I think it's a little bit more specific than just a generalized personification of death, but we'll see. Couple of things I have to get off my chest. This is a super popular opinion, but I love Gaetano and I've loved him since day one. I know he's ridiculous and crazy, but I still feel like it's a great fit.
Okay.
I honestly think I would agree with this interpretation. The only thing now, after I've seen the first 8 episodes, is I just don't understand what I'm supposed to make of Zalmer and Swanee's rolling up shop of his. Mm-hmm. Like, I really don't understand. Like, if he had bossed up and he still gets taken captured, because these are very, very terrifyingly adept women with guns. But I should have, that should have made both of their legends grow. Like, oh my God, yeah. Like, look how badass Zalmer and Swanee are. And Gaetano was lucky to get out of his life, but any other person would have just been rolled up like a cheap blind. But he basically pissed himself, killed his own dude, and got taken without a struggle.
Yeah.
What the shit?
No, I mean, there have been scenes that I've liked with Gaetano, certainly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't quite figured him out. Just like I haven't figured out Mr. Snowman.
And like I said, I do like the Godfather analogy that you've got Sonny and you've got Fredo. You just don't have a Michael in his family. Maybe Zero. Well, that would make sense because he's the baby, right? Zero sure. just isn't old enough.
No, he's
Zero's not.
Zero's
not old enough to be Michael Corleone. Yeah. Damn. the old man shouldn't have waited so long. Yeah. To have that follow up, but it is kind of funny to see like this family flailing around with that a real snake in the grass. Jacob continues, as always, enjoys your coverage. Although I have to say, I'm totally team Fish NATO, UFO, Big Lebowski, Purgatory, and all the other things y'all have had problems with so far. Fair point. Although I love the Big Lebowski Purgatory.
I like the Fish NATO. So like, I feel like the only one we're unanimous on is the UFO.
Yeah. Bald Move stands together in condemning the UFO plot of season 2.
Yeah,
we're issuing joint statements.
We do not stand with the rest of the internet, apparently, either. So,
no, yeah, that's fine. That's fine. So that's all the feedback we got. Although I will say that in the last few weeks, we've gotten a steady trickle of, what do you guys think about this Wizard of Oz theory? What do you guys think of this Wizard of Oz theory? And I've always dismissed it because I'm like, nah. Nah, look, okay, they name check Wizard of Oz and someone said that the Gaetano is like a tornado blowing through town. Mm-hmm. Pretty thin shit.
Yeah.
Here's a point where you need to turn it off if you don't want any spoilers. I'm going to give you some time to turn it off if you don't want any Wizard of Oz related spoilers. I still think that this theory is way too much and it's way too, they're trying to make it what a subtext text. But to be fair, and we're going to discuss this. This is a theory that has been promoted and conceived of on one of our friendly competitors, Fargo Talks Fargo podcast. Mm-hmm. I've heard nothing but good things from them, and people are really taking this theory. But the theory is like there's a lot of obvious parallels to the Wizard of Oz in this season. I didn't see them, but like they actually, you know, Thurman offered to read the Wizard of Oz to Ethelreda on those front steps. They did talk about this tornado blowing through. But they essentially said, you know, Ethelreda's Dorothy and Thurman's Smutney is the Scarecrow. And Detective Weff is, of course, the Cowardly Lion looking for his courage. And I don't know who the Tin Man is. I can't recall. But then it all boils down to Loy Cannon's the wizard. He's the man behind the curtain that's pulling the strings, and he's the... And I'm like, okay, well, this is kind of interesting, but there's very little predictive power other than all of the gang will have to eventually confront the wizard, which it does seem like they're kind of all on the same side of the wizard right now.
And whoever is the evil witch is going to get killed.
That's the other. Mayflower's the wicked witch of the West. There's like all these interesting theories. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe there's something there subtextual, but I'm not seeing it. And also, like, I'm not big fans of theories that don't have any predictive power. Like, okay, A plus B plus C equals what? If you don't got the equals, then who cares, you know? Maybe it'll be interesting Spark Notes essay, but it's not gonna help me get anything out of this. Then I see the preview for next week. It's an entirely black and white episode.
Yeah.
It takes place in Kansas. Remember, we're going to see.
Do we know it's an entirely black and white episode, or do we know that what they show us, which is all of a piece of like a same as just one scene, I think, is black and white? Is there more to it?
Something with Nick Cannon going on, or not? Jesus Christ, Loy Cannon's crew going on, and Lemuel, and I don't know why they would be in liberal Kansas, because I'm assuming that this is. You got Calamita going to liberal Kansas to track down. Mike, the Irish. The Rabbi Milligan is dumb enough to seek shelter at a feed store that he folded up and put in his personal Bible and left on his nightstand before he packed off. Okay, sure.
Yeah.
But we got a black and white episode where a tornado blows through Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty fucking Wizard of Ozzy. All right.
100%. Yeah.
So. I don't. I mean, maybe I need to go and listen to the Bone Up of my Fargo Talks Fargo podcasting. I don't know. Maybe we should interview these guys. But like, I don't know where it goes from here. I mean, I imagine it'll be a lot more clear next week. Like, is it going turn into color at some point? But also, next week is called East West, which is like, you know, we've got the one witches, wicked witch, perhaps. Like, where's the other one? I wonder. I do like. Like I said, I'm now open. My mind is open to what this Wizard of Oz theory might tell us. I just don't know. Like the predictive stuff, it didn't seem very strong. That didn't seem the theories. It's more of like, oh, look at all these cool parallels to, the Wizard of Oz. But I didn't like. Thurmond. Smutney is just not enough of a character to be the Scarecrow. You know,
that's the thing. Like some of these. I mean, look, the Wizard of Oz characters are archetypes, you know, they're broad, they're very, very fucking broad, and they can be laid over and mapped onto any number of characters you've seen in any show. The difference here being that they're very overtly going for a Wizard of Oz reference in this next episode, which surprised me, frankly. I was like, oh, well, if they're doing a Wizard of Oz thing, they're doing it from like the perspective of, oh, we, you know, it's a commentary on society, like the financial aspects of society, right? And like the gold standard and the greenback current, whatever. It's like, look, I'm not a Wizard of Oz scholar either. And I know people have literally studied this movie, this film for years in film school. It's a major watermark for cinema. So I'm also not very equipped to pick up on those things when they're there. But man, you just can't ignore it with the preview for next week.
Yeah, and like I remember when we were covering A Christmas Story for our Christmas coverage last year, they talked about how big Wizard of Oz was culturally at the time. Like that movie came out in 1939.
Yeah.
This is just 11 years later. Like
not a lot of movies came out back then. So,
right. The Wizard of Oz is essentially Star Wars plus Harry Potter plus the Hunger Games trilogy. Like it's like, it was this big thing that made this like big high watermark on American culture. And in the '50s, like that still being a thing, like the fact that like the extent that Harry Potter is still a thing and Star Wars is still a thing. And they are, you know, like that's that. So like it is of a piece for this stuff to And hell, it might even be another Christmas trapping. Like, you know, hey, you remember all the fun little Wizard of Oz? Like, if you watch a Christmas Story, you'll see all the, like, allusions to the Wizard of Oz. His teacher's the Wicked Witch, and they're going to the mall, and his dad's going arm-in-arm with Dorothy and the Scarecrow and the Lion, and, like, you know, they show up in the parade. Like, it's a big deal. And it might just be like, hey, this is also a Christmas tale, and it's small-town America, and maybe we can... Just in the same way, we've got a out of nowhere homage to this Brian De Palma film. We've got a little bit of an homage to Christmas Story, but I don't know.
I'll do my best to figure it out next week. But I'm a little nervous about it because I don't know enough about Wizard of Oz to give a definitive take. But
yeah, I'm now taking the Wizard of Oz theory somewhat seriously. I have sat up straight. I've adjusted my tie in its presence, and I'm ready to listen. But we'll see how it goes. That'll do it for us here on the Fargo podcast. Until next time, when we're no longer in Kansas anymore. If you'd like to send in more feedback, it's easy to do so. Fargo@baldmove.com. You can also, if you want to discuss this Wizard of Oz theory with our fellow fans, go to our forums, forums.baldmove.com. There's a Fargo thread there. We'll be back next week for East West or West East. It's East West. And until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
Jim.
See ya.